Berylum Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome once again to another action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. And this week, once again, you've been voting. It's your show, every bit as much as it is ours, for our topic to be put under the microscope. And I'm really looking forward to this one. It's a little bit different. We are going to shine a light, give a focus to our favourite sporting movies / documentaries. And there's so much to consider over the years. And spoiler alert, cannot believe we're not going to be talking about Rocky, at least from a team perspective. Come on, guys. Everybody loves the great Philadelphian fighter, etc., etc. But no, it's not going to feature amongst us today. I know, as always, you who have given us this topic, our wonderful loyal listeners, have had your opinions. And in a second, I'm circled back to our friend, the machine, Jason McKenna, to give us some insight into the action from the social media world. And indeed, without any further ado, I'm going to do precisely that. The machine, Jason McKenna, welcome again to Verulam Sport Podcasting.
Hello, Tony. Always a highlight of my week, and it's so fun to see what people have kind of suggested as well on social media. As you said, we had the vote to say which kind of topics we would proceed with over the next few weeks. And this one came out on top, and I'm not surprised because sport films, they really get you going. They're inspirational. And I'll just read out some of the title suggestions and end with, I think, quite a controversial comment that I think we can all tackle. But as you said, Rocky has been suggested by many. Once Upon a Lifetime, which is obviously about the football in America, Pelé, George Best all going at the same time. Drive to Survive, the fantastic Netflix series. When We Were Kings. Plus, somebody has mentioned that Muhammad Ali had a documentary on Netflix and Sky recently. Rush, Champion for a Weekend. And then somebody said, you've got to have the 1966 World Cup documentary because it's all about England winning and the Three Lions actually being victorious for once. So I love those shouts. However, Ian has messaged in and he said, I don't like sports films because they're unrealistic. And I think, you know, we've discussed it many times on here that actually that what goes on in sport is probably so crazy that you couldn't script it. I think that's something that you said many times, Tony.
Well, I mean, just talking Rocky, and it's such a, and people forget about Rocky, that are the original one scripted and directed by Sly Stallone, who also featured another great sports movie, which I don't think we're going to chat about tonight, Escape to Victory, and which has the likes of Pelé and Bobby Robson, a whole heap of other people. Great movie. But the thing is, talking Rocky, you know, I mean, in Rocky IV, he single-handedly takes down communism, God love him. But if you'd have pitched the script of, for instance, AJ Joshua versus Klitschko, Hollywood would laugh him out of the ball. They'd say, no, Sly, it's not on. We've done that. We've tried it. No, you can't be doing it again. You know, but it happened. It was there. It's a real thing in real life. And as you say, Jason, the drama of sport is one of the very reasons that I know we all live in. I know you listening to do too. And I can't wait very soon to unpack some of the finest sporting docs and movies out there. But do, as always, keep your views come in. There's so many, so much scope. Get involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Keep your opinions coming. Always, always love to hear from you. But right now, we are going to just, before we unpack the sporting movies, talk about the drama and indeed the theatre, which was the return of the Premier League. We've been building up to it. We're very excited, and it didn't fail to deliver, certainly from the drama point of view. I'm going to go firstly to our voice of the Saints, the phenomenal Graham Griffin, ex-pro, of course, for your take on, let's go for the initial one, the Sheffield United draw with Aston Villa. And I think you may have one or two things to say about what we'd eulogised about previously, Hawkeye goal line technology. Tell us some more. Your views, Graham.
Yes, good evening, Tony and team. And can you believe it? I did recall saying a couple of weeks ago that this goal line technology is 100% foolproof. It is amazing. It can never go wrong. And then what happened last night? It was clearly went wrong.
After 9,000 games.
After 9,000 games, exactly, Neil. And
I was going to say, Graham, you tell that right now to a Chrissy Wilder and team.
Absolutely. He's going to be gutted, right? But then I was looking at the statistics and the data, which Jace will be pleased about. I was looking at that on last night's game, and I think Sheffield United only had one shot on target, which I think that was the shot, to be honest. And we did talk about them during our European slotting podcast. And with that, what's interesting is that they're very clinical. So Aston Villa had more attempts, but not necessarily on target. So a 0-0, I think, was deserved from a possession play statistic perspective.
I mean, Graham, I've got to tell you, that's a very decent perspective. But at the end of the day, whether it is fair or otherwise, you don't need to have supreme technologically enhanced vision to see quite clearly, visually, that, and granted it was a howler by the goalie, but that so clearly, so blatantly crossed the line that, again, I just can't personally get over that at this time. Going to go across now to our data guru, the machine McKenna, for your take on the overall game, 0-0 as it was, and, of course, that moment.
Well, I think Sheffield United did what they do best. They kind of blocked out the game. But in a stylish way as well, they're not a boring team to watch. They do have some good counter-attacks, and getting it to Billy Sharp was kind of their main goal. But I think, when we analysed the Arsenal game as well, there was a lethargy to both teams. They're obviously kind of getting back into it, and it had more of a feel of a pre-season friendly than actually what it was, a relegation dogfight for Aston Villa and a European scrap for Sheffield United. I think on the balance of it, it probably should have been a 0-0, apart from the fact that the ball did cross the line. So I do feel very sad for Sheffield United. I feel it's unfair because if they had won that, they'd be occupying the fifth spot, which for this season, until we know otherwise, it is a Champions League spot. It's just really sad and unfair, and also quite irritating that the referee and the linesman probably did see it cross the line. The linesman is allowed to then say, I think the technology's wrong. He should have voiced it, and it would have gone to VAR. And also, why wasn't there a VAR intervention? This is something that obviously we discussed before, that VAR needs to intervene more sometimes and less on other occasions. It's really hard. So, it's a disappointing
massive,
game to
massive
watch.
Massive teething problems, as we've discussed here, with all these things with tech, particularly as it pertains to football. Sadly, it's been exposed literally from the kickoff of the return of the Premier League. Before I circle back to Graham on this point, and of course, as you say, Jason, we will analyse the Arsenal match too. But Neil, briefly, your thoughts on that goalless draw, Sheffield United Villa?
To be honest, it had 0-0 written all over it. However, what I don't understand is they've got seven cameras on the goal line or around the goal area, and they're using the excuse that either a goalpost, a goalkeeper or a defender blocked the signal go into the referee's watch. I think I got that correct there.
I mean, there's all kinds of things that's being said. They have actually come out and apologised. I think they have overtly and obviously recognised the error, but an error it was. And ultimately, I think the clear thing is, Graham did and brilliantly in his wonderful analysis, do check out our Sporting Tech podcast. It's absolutely gold dust in the sense that it was seemingly infallible and it just had that instantaneous in real time contact direct to the watch. Clearly that didn't flash, but then you think human common sense and the wit of man in this context should come into play, and there should be that consultation process.
But there are four or five officials
didn't go down.
again, maybe coming back to my point overall, this coming to what you're saying there, could well be too many cooks spoiling this broth, making a very murky one indeed. We're going to move on, but quickly, final points for you, our ex-pro, the voice of the Saints, yeah. Graham Griffin.
Yeah, and so two final things for me to make on that, Tony. You're absolutely spot on. And the first one is the bodies, this technology is designed from the cameras where the bodies shouldn't impact it. So there's technically something has failed there with Hawkeye. Maybe it's recovering from COVID-19, who knows. But it's something happened there they're not sharing with us. The second thing to say is when we talked about why didn't the linesman and the referee, remember on our last chat we said this is where technology can be a negative because the referee is now reliant on that watch vibrating on their wrist. If it doesn't, then the referee is 100% comfortable that that's a no goal. So we're now taking away the human element of the referee or lino making a decision. And that's what we discussed in the technology spot. That could be a negative in these scenarios, which was probably unthought of, to be fair. So I can't really blame the refs on that one. The technology has failed us.
I think everybody can see that. And again, they have, I think, come out and made certain statements along those lines. What it has done is it once again exposed the theatre and the drama of the Premier League, although perhaps from a slightly negative view. I am looking forward to drilling into the drama of sports, movies and docs very soon. But the drama of the Premier League continued. It was got underway Wednesday, midweek. It's going to continue on. And Jason, I want to come to you first for your thoughts on the first goal of the return of the Premier League, registered by Raheem Sterling of Man City. And I tell you what, he loves playing against your Gunners, doesn't he? My word.
Yeah, and, you know, as a neutral football fan, I was kind of glad to see that Raheem Sterling's got off once again because he's had a bit of a jaded season this year and he's not had his vintage usual self for whatever reason. I don't know why, but it was kind of good to see him back. Kevin De Bruyne was absolutely awesome as well, but the person at fault, Sideshow Louise, as us Arsenal fans call him, cost us the first goal, second goal as well, got himself sent off, and then undoubtedly that led to the third one. It was unfortunate because throughout the whole of that first half, Arsenal put in a fantastic performance, and yes, the first goal was probably a little bit unlucky because it bounced off Louise, but for Louise to then get himself sent off, unforgivable really in terms of it, but it was something that marked the rest of the match. But again, pre-season feel to the match. Arteta, unfortunately, due to the incident, wasn't able to kind of show Master Pep that he was ready to step up to his level. So hopefully we'll see as we move on in other games that Arsenal are improved. But at the moment, I haven't seen anything to the contrary.
I've got to tell you guys, I really appreciated your data-driven analysis on the race for Europe. But I've got to be frank, from what I'm seeing at Arsenal at the moment, it isn't looking hunky-dory. Again, we can't read too much into this first game back, and I'll take that. And I kind of want to be proven wrong here. I like Arteta, but I was talking to Cliff Crown from Brentford Football Club's chairman, and you can hear that literally after this today. Make sure you do. It's a great chat. And he was telling me about their pre-season game, literally a pre-season in this now context, against the Bees, against Arsenal, in which they beat the Gunners 3-2. And Arteta, by all accounts, really lost his rag, lost that sense of control. And I love the passion of the man, but I think you do need, in order to be a long-term success, to be able to rein it in. The irony, of course, is I will always be a Jose Mourinho man, and I think enough said there. I do recognise the irony. But like I say, the concerns there is, look where Arsenal are, looking up. I just didn't feel that sense of cohesion. I think you're right, Jason. They put in a lot of huff and puff and a lot of endeavour in that early games. But looked to me, or at least sounded to me from what I was hearing, that the Man City always had that extra drive, that extra gear. And granted, Man City will have that against most teams they encounter. But I don't know. I'm a little concerned for Arsenal at this time. And I don't yet know. It remains to be proven whether Arteta is going to capture that Pep-esque magic or otherwise. I'm dubious at this moment. Going across though to Graham for his thoughts.
Yes, exactly, Tony. And I would agree with you there. And me and Jason have spoke about this as well. I think there needs to be an expectation reset for the Arsenal fans. I think they're definitely a mid-table club at the moment. It's going to take a long time to get to where they need to. They've had all the years under Wenger. I think he'll do okay, Arteta, but he won't do anything amazing like Pep. I think people are associating them two things too closely. So he's his own man. He's going to take time. I don't think he's the solution. And I think Arsenal have got a long time in the mid-table to maybe top seven.
I fear that may prove to be the case. We shall see. Always time tells. Always things can change. All you need is a bit of magic and a bit of an impetus, and momentum is a great wave to ride. We shall see. One thing I will add just very quickly before I go to Neil on this. Jason, just for one second, assume from your perspective the worst, that there is a fallow period in Arsenal's history. How long will it be before they have to listen to the fans and reduce what are, at the moment, the costliest season tickets in the Premier League? Surely they can't justify that if it is going to be the case that there's no longer the guarantee of Champions League. In fact, Champions League may be, at the moment, at best a pipe dream. Your thoughts briefly on that, I guess, thorny topic.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, and I think it has been discussed for many years, because when Arsenal entered the Emirates Stadium, it was the promise of Ivan Gazidis and Arsene Wenger that we were going to be competing with the elite of Europe. And then what transpired was being knocked out regularly by the likes of Bayern, Barcelona. In the early stages of the Champions League, we only got to the semi-final once during our time at the Emirates. So it's, promises haven't been kept. And kind of a first signal towards what you're alluding to there, Tony, was the fact that they've frozen season ticket prices for a few years now on the trot. But undoubtedly so, Arsenal are not going to be able to draw in the crowds. We saw it last season under the turgid football of Emery. People were not coming. The only way to get people through the doors is either to lower prices or incentivize it some other way with good football. So we shall see. I think it's a very soon topic on the horizon, and that obviously will filter down into the team that we won't be able to buy players, we won't be able to do the things that we once were. And as Graham has rightly said, at the moment, Arsenal cannot expect to compete with teams even like Leicester and Wolves, who have been run so much better and spending better than us as well. We've got Luiz on the books, a waste of money, that people will not want to pay to come to see. The top prices in the Premier League, I think in Europe as well, for season tickets.
Can I just add to that very quickly, Tony? Just to say on, because I know Arsenal, I'm going to defend Arsenal here because they do get bad press on this, and the headline from media is they're the most expensive tickets going. But I appreciate all the other things Jesse said. Actually, when you work it out, they're the 14th most expensive Premier League ticket. And the reason for that is a Premier League ticket is normally just, it excludes the first seven cup games, whereas at least Arsenal give that as part of their price. So when you take them seven cup games out, they're probably mid-table when it comes to ticket pricing for the Premier League.
It's appreciated they're the 360, but I'm still dubious about the overall package, given the fact that that model was predicated on almost like Leeds, badly run, atrociously run, back in the early 2000s, that saw them slide all the way down. They justified their cost again on this dream of Premier League football. And if that dream is not even close to a reality, then I think you have to question the package, and I know the fans are, and they will be voting with their feet all too soon. But now, talking football, just finally, as we wrap up this Premier League chat, Neil, your thoughts on the Man City performance and their 2-0 victory. Does that give them still a bit more hope, perhaps, of hunting down Liverpool, albeit still a mountain to climb?
Well, Liverpool need two wins, apparently, from the data that I heard last night. So they need two wins from their last nine, ten games. Man City obviously need to win them all to stand any sort of hope. Man City, that injury to, was it Garcia last night? That could see them sort of with that player down, but obviously Phil Foden coming in, he's done quite well. He was doing well before before COVID set in. I just want to bring up this new thing about the additional subs.
Five are allowed, aren't they? Interesting.
I didn't really get my head round it last night, how it was all how it all is meant to work. So I don't know whether maybe Graham or Jason maybe had a shed additional light on that one.
For across GG, can you put us in the picture?
I, to be honest, I've not kept myself up to speed in it. I lost interest when it went from what you could only have two subs years ago. Now then it went to seven. And after that, I was like, where are we going with this? Is it a basketball game or what? So sorry, Neil, I'm not up to speed on that one either.
Jason, have you got the inside scoop or any tool on this? I know we're allowed five, and the mindset, the logic, and I can understand it. We've talked about it in previous podcasts. The condensed nature of this now sprint to the end of this ultra-marathon Premier League season increases massively by 25%, according to some findings, the probability or possibility of injury. So obviously enabling key players to keep fresh, to have that extra substitution up to five now, is, I think, designed principally just to kind of dovetail this season and at least allow the best possible chance of managing players and decreasing accordingly that heightened risk of injury. As to the nuances of it, Jason, anything to add?
Yeah, so what happens is during the match you can have five subs in total. You can have three maximum on one occasion, and that's to kind of spread it out, but also so that people can't then do five all at once and waste time. And they've also have to spread them out over a certain period of time, which I can't give you the exact moment, but they're allowed some in the first half and some in the second half again, so that it's not coming up to 90 minutes and then we're bringing on one sub, or we'll bring on sub number two. We've seen in the Bundesliga that teams generally use about four subs now instead of three. And also interesting data is that substitutes have, I'm going to say the swear word, Tony, a higher XG than those on the pitch. So I think the average player has a 0.15 XG, and it goes up to about 0.25 to 0.28 XG for substitutes coming on. Whether teams will kind of exacerbate that and kind of exploit that in the Premier League, we shall see. But it's not been exploited in the Bundesliga. But yeah, it's an interesting facet of the game. And maybe those who can adapt to the situation might do very well out of it.
It's all about adaptation at this moment. There is a rugby analogue where there's been this phrase being dotted around for many years. And I've got to be honest, Graham, I'm a dinosaur like you, buddy. I'm not a big fan of substitutions in rugby generally. It used to be, you know, you practically have to be borderline dead before somebody could come across. But that being said, there's this concept that's been around now for many moons in rugby called the finishers. Players that sort of specialise in coming on with maybe 20 minutes left, 15, where there are those tired bodies, those spaces open up, and they kind of, you know, their job, their remit is to seal the deal, to finish tries, to make the difference. Maybe lack the overall fitness of some other players, perhaps. But yes, there is an analogue in rugby. It's going to become certainly part of the new norm as we all look to adapt and to evolve. But I tell you what is never normal is the world of sport. It throws up so many great debates, and it's also mirrored in the world of movies and indeed some phenomenal documentaries. And right now, I'm really keen to get this underway. And I'm going to throw across, firstly, to Graham Griffin for your first choice sporting documentary or movie that you want to expose, put under the microphone, so to speak. But just before I do, Graham, I'm going to give a massive, massive shout out to your other half, the wonderful Grace Heatherby. I know Grace is a massive fan. I know she's always listening in, has exciting thoughts as well. So Grace Heatherby, I'm sending my big up respect to thee. Thanks for listening.
She will love that, Tony, because she's a big fan, listening in, probably to massage my ego, but she loves the debate. She loves the stato in Jace and obviously the commentary from yourself. And Neil, obviously, there's more to come on that one. But yes, I've gone for two, and there were so many. I love sports documentaries and I love the inside. But like Jason said with Neil, one of our listeners a little bit earlier, you know, what's the point? They're not realistic. And probably one of the reasons for that is it won't be allowed to be aired if some of these sports are realistic. So it's trying to allow, obviously, with all the commissions and all the things you're allowed to say and do. So they get close to it. And the first one I'm going to discuss is More Than a Manager. So who is it? It's the wonderful Bobby Robson. Now, what a guy, what an individual. And I think what I really like about this guy, he just had the emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. And never really quite got there with the England team. We saw what happened in 86 and 1990. But I like how he didn't let the pressure he got from the media, which, to be fair, he wasn't treated very well with the media. They were very nasty in that time. And, you know, they were just spreading bad news. The tabloids, newspapers, or the broadsheets weren't the best, were they? They've calmed down a little bit of late also, although still not the best journalism. But you look at that, and he never once allowed that crack, or he never put that crack onto his players. He still maintained that rapport and reputation with them. So for me, I just thought that captured him as a person. And I think if we can get more leaders in sport, be more human rather than actually trying to be something else and turn people into robots or machines, that human element, he got the respect from Gary Lineker, Stuart Pearce, Alan Shearer. They all loved him as a person and they all ran through brick walls for him. And I think that says a lot when it comes to this beautiful thing called sport, which is there's more to it than anything else we do in life. There's just so many different facets that are seen, unseen, conscious, unconscious. And I just thought he was the master. Excuse me. And I was disappointed he didn't win the FA Cup with Newcastle in 1998. Yeah. That was his hometown team. And he got them to two FA Cup finals twice, didn't he, consecutively. And he just lost out. So I think I would have loved to have seen him one win more. But just what a brilliant leader in sport. What a brilliant gentleman. And what a brilliant individual to get the best out of individuals, I felt.
And what a brilliant documentary it is. Incidentally, it's put together by the phenomenal Noah Media Group and one of the key producers of this wonderful movie. And if you haven't watched it, do check it out. It is a phenomenal tale about a phenomenal man. But one of the producers is no relation to our machine, Jason McKenna, a great guy called John McKenna. And I'm going to be chatting to him on Saturday, not just about more than a manager, but about what he's got in the pipeline and his take on the art of documentary movies. He's a great chap. Make sure you're checking that out. It's going to be available from Saturday. Do you know what's great about this movie, though? I think you made some wonderful points there, GG. But I love the fact that it touches on the fact that he was at Barcelona and you introduced my man, Jose, who was originally kind of involved in his translation team. Amazing what life journeys can occur. But the seemingly to a man, the love, the admiration for Bobby oozes out on the screen, off the camera. And it strikes me as so supremely authentic. And the tone of this documentary, I think, is so special. It truly, do check it out. And I love again about him, Sir Bobby Robson, that for all the great things he's done, again, there across the continent, many, many teams, England manager, what this does show, at least initially, doesn't focus in on it. But what it does expose is that amazing, almost transcendental efforts for the provincial, very small team in footballing historical terms, Ipswich Town. And what he did there to get them into a European contender, astonishing. It's a great life story, incredibly well narrated, great shout. GG. Now, just briefly before we introduce our newest recruit, Neil Stock, for his choice on the movies and documentaries from the sporting arena that he would like to dissect, I'm going to go across to Jason for your thoughts on More Than a Manager.
Yeah, I love that documentary. You know, it seems like a recurring theme here, but it is my Nana McKenna's favourite documentary. She loves Sir Bobby, and obviously, you know, he managed Ipswich in her area growing up. But in terms of the documentary, it kind of shows you different styles of management. You know, we talked to Pep Guardiola in there, we talked to Mourinho, and as Tony said a little bit earlier, he was somebody that was transcendent. He connected kind of opposing football ideologies there. And he himself, you know, I'm sure he was a great tactician, but his main facets were this ability to just connect all, no matter race, creed, whatever. He was a wonderful unifying character that everybody loved. And I think that the documentary really got it off there as a man who was a gentleman from beginning to end. And also it kind of highlighted probably the disrespectful way that Barcelona and him parted company as well. But the fact that even in that kind of crisis there, he still maintained his dignity. And then he went on to big and amazing things at Newcastle. You know, they were a club in turmoil. He took them over top four every season. And then they sacked him when, oh, suddenly they got a European spot instead of Champions League. And well, you can see that they probably regret that
again,
decision.
The expectations of certain fans is very skewed and very narrow sometimes, as we've discussed in the past. Appreciate your insights there. And looking forward to chatting to a namesake of yours, Jason, John McKenna, who was heavily involved in this wonderful documentary. And again, if you haven't enjoyed this, you must go out and check out Bobby Robson, More Than a Manager. And as I say, stick with us on Verum Sport Podcasting to hear from John McKenna, who literally was an instrumental part of putting together this fabulous documentary. But right now, it's over to Neil for his first choice from the world of sporting movies or / documentaries. What you got for us, Neil?
Right, I'm going to go for the first one, moving away from the usual football, going for a boxing theme with Raging Bull. Martin Scorsese, back in the early 80s, 1980, took on Jake LaMatta's memoirs, along with another producer, and basically turned the memoirs into a black and white boxing film, shall we say. I've seen little bits of it.
Yeah.
The main points that I would like to raise about that is the Jake LaMatta's private life, if you like, tended to overshadow his boxing capabilities, and he didn't actually make the big time because of that, because of his paranoia, jealousy, etc., etc. There's a bit that I saw a clip earlier today where he was convinced that I think it was his brother was seeing his wife behind his back or something like that.
It's a wonderful performance by Pecci as well, who, again, that was actually his first role as the brother and also the manager. And I tell you what, it's a great, great, great shout. I kind of jokingly said, get Rocky in there, and I really do maintain that. But in the world of boxing movies, this is top, top draw. Nominated for 8 Academy Awards, claiming 2. De Niro is the lead man playing DeMotta. Method acting here, par excellence. I mean, the guy committed to this role to such a degree, he'd pile on 60 pounds for the later scenes of the later years of LaMatta, again, with substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and overall slightly kind of stressful lifestyle choices. He obviously did pile on the pounds. 60 pounds.
Because that was also brought in on that subject in the film itself, about the weight that was piled on. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
From what I've seen, that's
truly method acting to the nth degree. Richly deserved the Oscar, and also claimed Oscar awards for best editing. Because, as you say, it's this harrowing black and white style. Lots of cuts, lots of changes of angles. It's a real golden movie. I think it was the first movie to get into the sort of Hollywood Hall of Fame or prestige movies list in its first year in which it was eligible for that. But yeah, it's a truly wonderful movie, as you rightly say, Neil.
It's about 13 awards they won there for that film.
I appreciate you actually haven't seen it in full, and I recommend that you do. And if you haven't also listening in, this is very much a 18 certificate. It is very harrowing, but it's so well produced. Many people consider it the magnus opus of Martin Scorsese, who himself is a genius behind the camera. But from what you have seen, Neil, what were some of the key moments? What do you think kind of made you feel as though this is certainly one that's going to be worth chatting about tonight?
It was just the way... Obviously, everybody knows, bringing it back to Rocky, everybody knows about Rocky, but this one seemed to be one of those, for me, that was sort of a little bit in the background, and sort of, even though it's won these awards, it was a little bit in the background, and I just thought it may have been, because I did think about Rocky, that the four or five films that you could have picked from. But this one, it was just one of those that I felt that needed to be brought to the front just for a little while, just to show that there are other boxing movies available.
Absolutely. And truly, truly, it's worth every single award it's claimed. It is truly a masterpiece. Graham, have you seen Raging Bull?
I have, and I think I'd agree with everything that you've said. and in particular the direction and production. I think that's fantastic. But also I think that captures quite a lot of stories that we don't hear about because of the nature of that type of thing. And if you link it back to Fight Club, you know, with Brad Pitt, that is another brilliant example of the boxing world underground. And I think that's what's really important to capture, really, is that actually all these stories are happening every day around the world.
Yeah, very true. And I'll tell you what, as you said, Neil, it's actually based on LaMotta's memoir, 1970 memoir, Raging Bull, My Story. And again, it's just an epic tale. They're full of the highs and the emotional lows. De Niro is truly sublime in it. Jason, your thoughts on Raging Bull?
It's actually one that I've not seen, which is a shame, and also probably not good as a boxing fan, person that does boxing as well. But from the reviews that everybody's kind of given here, you know, it has stood the test of time. It's one of those ones that has been in the consciousness for many years. But as Neil's kind of rightly pointed out, it's kind of sad that maybe in comparison to Rocky, it's not as widely kind of talked about. And, you know, it's obviously missed me out. But maybe, you know, I should go and watch it after this.
I highly recommend it. If you're listening and you haven't checked out Raging Bull, do see this. It lives up to the hype. It's worth every single Oscar. It is a very harrowing movie. Don't go into this thinking you're going to get some popcorn goodness. It is very, very intense. But as a study of human nature, the foibles and the intensity, the pressures that befit us all, it is a masterpiece. It's a magnus opus of Scorsese. It's world class. Well worth checking out. But now, Jason, to you, the Machine McKenna, a man I know loves a good movie and a good sporting documentary. What's the first one that you want to unleash for us tonight?
Yeah, so the first one that I'm going to talk about is actually Senna. It's a documentary, and kind of like the previous one, Raging Bull, it is harrowing. It's not something that you can really watch to kind of get an uplifting. There are amazing moments in it, because obviously it's about one of the greatest, as I've said before, I'd probably say second now to Lewis Hamilton, but one of the greatest drivers of all time. And it's so amazing. It's near fly on the wall level for its kind of in-depth nature. It follows him from his start in 1984 all the way until his very tragic early passing. Mm-hmm. And it really does capture the bitter rivalry between him and Prost, but also Jean-Marie Balestre, or some racing fans call him another kind of twist on that name. But yeah, it was really fascinating. It captures so much drama. I think there's some really good themes throughout the film as well. There's an irony that throughout the whole of the documentary, he's talking about the sports safety. He's a very selfless character. You know, on the races, you know, he was fearless, he was fiercely competitive, but also a very compassionate, loving man. He jumped out of his car to save another driver once. You know, he was a man that was a good person at heart at that. Also, I think towards the end, you know, I'm skipping a lot of it here because I don't want to spoil it for people, but the end was, it was saddening. It was shocking. It encapsulated what was one of the worst losses in sport history. It starts off with like...
Tragically, doesn't it also trace the fact that another racer, Ratzenberger, died on the almost the eve, I think. It was a very tragic and kind of almost infamous race, that 94 San Marino one, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the thing is, there's almost like a spooky nature to it, because the night before, he read the Bible, and it opened up to a very kind of prophetic passage. As you said there, you know, Ratzenberger was killed, Rubens Barrichello injured during qualifying. Pedro Lamy started the race very badly and was hit in a high impact crash. And then obviously, sadly, the fatal crash happened on lap 7. But obviously, it is a fantastic, fantastic film. But there were a few elements that I thought were kind of overplayed or maybe that I would be criticised. One of the first things was there was a quote in there, and it was Ayrton Senna ran out of luck, and that maybe he kind of pushed it a little bit too much, which I think is wrong to say, because to be a good F1 driver, you have to do it. And kind of Senna combated that himself by saying, If you don't go for a pass, or if you don't go for the takeover and it's there, then you're no longer an F1 driver. And I think that some of the quotes in there kind of showed you how jealous it was. Also, Prost was shown as the kind of anti-Senna. He was shown as the enemy. And yes, there was a fierce, fierce battle. But actually, towards the end there, in 1994, they'd actually kind of reconciled. And that doesn't really show until right at the end when they kind of go, Prost stepped up and kind of took over the charity. And you're like, oh, that's really nice. But it doesn't show that actually they were two respectful sportsmen right at the end. So Prost kind of, after this came out, describes his reservations and sadness that they hadn't shown how he and Senna had reconciled it, because obviously the meta narrative in F1 is that they're against each other, which is fair, but I think that's one of the only things that I'd kind of take away and say that should be redressed. But otherwise, it's one of the best insights that you can have into the absolute legend that is Senna.
Do you know what really struck me in this is absolutely almost similar to Bobby Robson, his sheer passion for what he did, whether that was literally one of the most innovative and fearless drivers, to his, as you say, his compassion and his almost banging the drum on a high political level for increased safety. You know, that sheer, everything was done to the max with Senna, and I really, really value that. For me, I think you made some really compelling points about maybe a minor gripe in the kind of black and white divide, the white-hatted Senna versus the black-hatted, to put in a cowboy movie parlance, Prost. And it's always more nuanced than that. But one of the things about sport that we love, it almost elevates the game, makes it get people talking about this drama, is when you have these intensive rivalries. And they were poles apart in their characters and their approach to racing. And I think that was maybe laid on a touch thick, perhaps for entertainment value, but it doesn't alter the fact that that is one of the reasons why both Senna and Prost will always be remembered in history. Because when you've got those two greats going at it, almost, you know, different styles, it makes the narrative so compelling. And again, that breeds that real life sporting theatre and drama. Great shout, The Machine. Appropriately goes for the high-octane machine-driven world of F1 with Senna. Speeding across to Graham very quickly, though, please, Mr. GG, for your take on this wonderful Senna doc.
Brilliant choice, Jace, and brilliantly well-articulated. Everything you said makes total sense. Just one thing I want to say on that movie, it made me angry, and it made me angry because Senna didn't need to die. And the reason, one of the reasons that he was in that situation is because the sort of leaders or the directors or the owners of F1 at the time were very egotistic. And we see that in sport. That's when problems occur. And all the drivers were telling the owners of the sport, this is dangerous, help us out. And they weren't listening. And unfortunately, it took a death such as Senna on obviously a few before. And let's not forget the British driver who was badly injured in, I forget his name, but he broke his leg severely in a very horrendous crash a couple of years sooner. And I think after that, the positive of it all, if it could be a positive, is that Formula One became a lot safer. And the doctor who'd been around for many years, I forget his name, but he was a pioneer in changing it to get it so safe today for us to see the likes of Schumacher and Hamilton do what they've done. So them guys can be risky, exactly what Senna's strategy was. But it's so much safer now because of it, which is wonderful. But I was angry that they didn't listen to the drivers sooner. And that's what happens in sports administration, unfortunately, sometimes. Ego takes over.
Surely not. Surely ego and lots of money and these, that and the other do not mean that the safety and the overall well-being of the sport take paramount importance always in the world of sports administration. Surely, Graham, I don't know. Anyway, going now back to yourself, Graham, the voice of the Saints, Graham Griffin, for your next take, your next choice in the world of sports movies or / documentaries.
So mine is a documentary, my second and final one, and it's actually called The Last Dance. Now, this is amazing, this. It's currently on Netflix. And the reason I love this is because it sees the best of every ingredient to be successful in sport. And I'll break that down for you. So you get the best player. You get the best mentality. You get the competitive edge to win. You get the best coach. you get the best organization, you get the best facilities, you get actually the best outcomes, you get championships, all these things. It's so hard to do. And what I want to say with The Last Dance is it's about an American basketball team. It's Chicago Bulls. And in 1984 all the way through to 1988, they had a really interesting time. And the one interesting person in this team was the one and only Michael Jordan. And Air
Mike
Jordan.
Air Jordan.
Exactly, the Air Jordan Nike trainers, if you remember that into the 90s. Jace won't remember that. Me, you, Tony and Neil. Surely we will.
Yeah, definitely.
And they made Nike, or he made Nike. He preferred Adidas, but obviously they went with Nike. And the story of this is that actually he drove as a captain. He drove his players to be better. A lot of players didn't like him. They thought he was a bully, this, that, and the other. Other players blossomed, the Dennis Rodmans and the Scotty Pepin and such. They were outstanding. But the key here is Phil Jackson, right? So if you ever want to... if you ever want to be a coach, be it amateur, professional, if you ever want to just do well as a leader in business, this is the documentary to watch, because Phil Jackson got a job as an assistant to Dougie Collins, and then he ended up taking over from Dougie Collins, and he won 5 championships in a row, which was phenomenal. And Dougie Collins, the coach before, played his team just around Michael Jordan. Brilliant for Michael Jordan, but the team never won anything, whereas Phil... Jackson got Michael Jordan to see how he could get the best out of others and work as a team. So a brilliant example of teamwork, and they ended up with 6 trophies in the 90s. Most successful sports team ever, you could argue. And the great
We will be debating sporting dynasties, I think, next week. I suspect these guys could well be in contention. Great show. I haven't actually seen this yet. I've had loads of people highly recommend it to me. Again, you mentioned that relationship between Jackson, the coach, and Jordan, essentially the heartbeat, the leader of the team. What I love about that, Graham, is though this weird one, isn't there, sometimes between when you are that gifted and you do have that immense laser focus, which Jordan clearly did, sometimes that alienates you from the others. How did Jordan evolve as a leader, taking into account and embracing other people who maybe are not so laser-focused?
Brilliant point. And because he had, when he'd had people stand up to him, all he was looking for is somebody to stand with him. So his own insecurity made him realize that actually people are there for him. But equally, he got the best out of others and they got the best out of him. So it was that whole comradeship and getting to know one another, which was crucial. And you're totally right. You could argue there's a lot of people that he alienated himself from. But the point was, it didn't matter, because he had this competitive need to win, as Phil Jackson did. And therefore, they achieved that. That was his whole purpose and aim. He wasn't a statesman, a politician. He was a sports person who wanted to win. So it was ingrained with him from his brothers from a young day. And he wasn't even the best sportsman. But don't forget, he went off to play baseball for about a year, didn't he?
Yeah, I remember.
In between. And then he came back and he said, I don't want to play basketball in 1998, because he didn't want to be coached by anybody else better, which was Phil Jackson. And previous, when Phil Jackson was the assistant, he didn't really get on with Phil Jackson. He didn't rate him. But in 1998, Phil Jackson called it the last dance, because the general manager was getting rid of him. And this last dance was like a memoir of how to be and how to work. And they were all going to lose their contracts and this, that, and the other, which was phenomenal. So just shows through adversity, you can still achieve quite a lot.
Absolutely love it. Brilliantly broken down. I've had this recommended from a lot of people. I need to get myself in the world of The Last Dance. Jason, is this something that's coming to your radar at all? I know it's very popular. Again, I haven't seen it myself.
Yeah, I haven't watched it all the way through. But I think, again, it's one of the most fascinating kind of fly-on-the-wall things. Interesting to me that it's kind of taken so long to come out as well, because obviously the Chicago Bulls were huge in the 90s, and I thought that something like this would probably come out then. But it's the way the world works, you know, with the Senna documentary, it kind of takes a team to bring together all these little facets. In terms of, like, Graham, they're talking about the dynasty and the last dance. What is interesting to me as well is, did the management get it wrong with letting them go too soon, or did they not prepare enough for it? Because since then, what have the Chicago Bulls won? They haven't won a championship ever since. They've kind of come close here and there, but it does bring into question about sport management and all these kind of things. Jordan wanted the team to stay together. He really fought for a lot of these characters, and he put himself on the line to be criticised from it. There was also kind of like sporting data in there. Maybe once again, you can kind of say that this is where sporting data might have been wrong, saying that these players were coming to the end of their careers. But it's a truly fascinating documentary, and it's no surprise that it's kind of top of Netflix at the moment, kind of inspiring people as well to kind of that last dance, give it all towards the end.
Final quick question on this, because as I say, I've not seen this yet, so forgive me if this is a bit of a silly question. But one thing that I know about Michael Jordan at the Bulls is that he was instrumental in selecting Rodman. Rodman was basically not particularly gifted going forwards, not one of the greatest shooters. You know, there were those amongst him who would joke that he couldn't even hit a free throw. But what he was supremely gifted at was sort of rebounds. He was like the rebound king. Almost that was his specialism, literally that focused. And Jordan noticed a gap in the team's strengths, or a deficit, as it were, and said, Rodman is the man, controversial as he is, to fit that gap. And we win big. Is that alluded to at all in the doc?
Not necessarily, but what was interesting of why they brought Rodman in, they lost Horace Grant, who went to, I think, LA Raiders, and he was one of their powerful defensive players. And Jordan needed that so he could play his game. So when he brought Rodman in, he was a bit rough around the edges, but he was one of the best defensive players in basketball at the time. And he'd study every opponent. This guy was very clever. He wasn't just what people would see him to be, you know, very arty in his hair design and his nails and stuff. This guy was a very technically very good professional. And also what was interesting is that Michael Jordan, when they lost Scottie Pippen to injury, it was Jordan who actually pulled Rodman aside, who wasn't playing very well, and said, "I need you. The team needs you. You are better than this." And then with that responsibility and trust given, Rodman just blossomed. And then that's when the Bulls just went on another amazing run without Scottie Pippen. So it was just this, you know, everybody wants to be wanted, right? Everybody wants to be somebody. And this is what Michael Jordan, as a leader, to me, was the undercurrent leader, where he did get the best out of people, albeit in tough methods and such. It's just wonderful. And I think back to the point Jace mentioned, from a perspective of why did they break this dynasty up? It was crazy. There was no need. And look at Manchester United, you know, with Ryan Giggs and Paul Scholes. They didn't say, "Oh, you're 36. The data must suggest that you're knackered." You know, they were like, "Keep playing." Why? Because you're good and you can play.
Absolutely.
Why didn't they just leave them alone? You know, let them get on with it.
One suspects, as always, it comes back to that horrible, fawny thing of ego, and ego gets into play and then it gets all a bit confused. But I tell you what, such a good shout. I haven't seen it, but it has been heartily recommended. And the way you've marvellously deconstructed it, that, Graham, certainly got to get that in my world. Talking Michael Jordan, he's certainly got to be in contention for what you might refer to as the Mount Rushmore of all sports. My first sporting doc is going to include another man who's got to maybe be front and centre of the Mount Rushmore of all of sports. BBC's sport personality of the century, the greatest, Mr. Muhammad Ali. There's loads of movies, of course, referencing this larger-than-life character. His true story is so big that no one movie or one documentary can truly do it the full justice it requires. But this comes mighty close. When We Were Kings, from 1996, directed by Leon Guest, highlighting, really bringing up some wonderful archive footage from The Rumble in the Jungle, Ali Foreman, Zaire, October the 30th, 1974. Maybe one of the finest comebacks in all sporting history. Again, Ali brought his career full circle, going from the youngest heavyweight champion of the world and here beating another insurmountable foe in George Foreman, adopting the famous or infamous rope-a-dope methodology in Zaire to become the oldest heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, some people in life, they just, by their strength of their will, allied with phenomenal talent, literally create magic and movie stories. And you talk about people who say these stories can't be true, they're just not ever going to be like that. You tell that to Muhammad Ali. I mean, goodness me, check this out. This is mind-blowing. This is come off the hour, come off the man, carpe diem encapsulated. So it's in an outdoor arena in Zaire. Wonderful arena, and again, lots politics behind the scenes, writ large and exposed in When We Were Kings. But it's in an open-air arena. Now, people forget, the actual Rumble itself was scheduled previously for 6 months before, but Foreman got an injury, meaning it had to be postponed. It couldn't be cancelled. There was so much money at play here, so many political aspects. So it was postponed for 6 months, making the fight date October the 30th, 74. After all this wonderful boxing with, again, Ali almost does the unprecedented. Jason, as a boxer, you'll know this. Almost nobody will use the right-hand lead. It leaves you too open to counterattack. It's almost, you're almost considered mad, insane to adopt it. Ali did just that in the opening round, scoring heavily. People forget he was actually up on points in the first three rounds before adopting almost just unilaterally the rope-a-dope technique, where he literally embraced and allowed this behemoth of Foreman to pummel him on the ropes as he dodges as best as he can. My word. But then coming back to this unbelievable point, right? The moment of the eighth round where the knockout from Ali coming off the ropes. And I tell you, there's so many brilliant pictures festooning so many students' bedroom of this moment where the punch is done. It's beautiful. And Foreman, he's exhausted. He's physically battered. And then Ali almost cocks as if to throw another blow, and he stops it. He knew it would just spoil the aesthetic of that moment. And his look of jubilation on his face, because he just knew. He knew he had executed his plan to perfection. But this is where the legend kicks in. But it's not just legendary, it's reality, okay? All these combination of rarities, freakish moments, culminate in, at that precise second, hasn't rained in Zaire for like 8-9 months. Open-air arena, remember, don't forget that. Heaven's open. Heaven's open. If that punch hadn't landed then, that would have been game over, because that fight would have been called off, because he simply cannot box in the rain in an open air context. I mean, it's just storybook stuff. You cannot write this, but he did. He lived it. He willed it. He made it. He is the greatest. Muhammad Ali, what a man. And this story is beautifully told. It's got some very, very compelling kind of expert pieces from great journalists like Tommy Hauser, who knew this story inside and out. Spike Lee, another great filmmaker, eulogizes about Ali's role in black empowerment then, and indeed transcending all time. It's still irrelevant today. Tell you what, this movie, if you haven't watched it, if you're only going to watch one movie on Muhammad Ali, check out When We Were Kings, because truly this man, Ali Bumbaye, Ali kill him, he did just that, and this documentary slays it. Masterpiece.
Yeah, I just love it, Tony, and there's so much to it. You know, going back to Ian's kind of message at the start about, oh, sports films, documentaries, unrealistic. This one is kind of biblical. Like you said there, the rain coming down. It was like God himself kind of interjected at that moment, say, it mm-hmm. is done. There's just so many amazing moments. I think in many ways, it is an insult to Ali to just say he was a boxer. He was more than a boxer. When people say he's the greatest, you got to say that he wasn't just one of the greatest boxers. He was one of the greatest people of all time for the work that he did on and off the boxing canvas. He was fantastic. And yeah, I like your reference there to the kind of Ali kill him, because I love the story that as he was coming off the plane, he spoke to his manager and he said, what's something that I can say that will rile them up? And then he was like, who do they hate out here? You know, they were kind of racking their brains, and then they said, oh, say that he's Belgian, because obviously kind of the imperialistic route. And so Ali said to the crowd, George Foreman is a Belgian. And then they suddenly go, kill him, kill him. That's where it comes from.
Ali Bumbaye, Ali Bumbaye. I can hear it all my life just resonating. And it's so powerful, wonderful stuff there.
There's a really funny moment as well, though, that the fact that George Foreman brought his dog with him, his lucky dog.
Yeah.
And in terms of imperialism, this German shepherd was the dog used to suppress the people of Zaire. So it just all played into the narrative of Ali. Again, something circumstantial, something unintentional then kind of adds to this amazing, amazing narrative. And like you said there, if you're going to watch any of the kind of films that we're talking about here, When We Were Kings, to do it justice to one of the greatest people of all time, not just a great boxer, Muhammad Ali, you've got to watch it. I mean, have you seen it yourself as well, Graham?
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen quite a lot on it, and Cassius Clay, isn't it? You know, you think, wow, just another generational gem, you know, where we get these people, don't we, who are just have this ambition, drive or determination to become something and then have the strength physically, mentally. So he's in that category, isn't he? Similar to Michael Jordan we earlier talked about as well. It's just phenomenal, and we see it now with other people who are phenomenal, but this guy was a great in what he could do, but equally as a personality, as he just had, it's interesting, isn't it? That era, that them characters, they just had something more than their sport. They were really interesting to listen to.
Do you know what I will say? Just closing up on When We Were Kings, I really, really wish, in a way, he kind of hung up the gloves after this match. It was poetic. It was romance all over it. And again, all these combination of rare, you could call them, you know, just occurrences or coincidences. For me, the strands of his overall narrative mean that they were meant to be on some kind of level I don't fully really understand, but it's just sublime. But I truly wish he had hung up the gloves, because obviously he went on, he carried on, and subsequently obviously acquired or gained or have you Parkinson's. And Jason, you're dead right, he never ever lost that humanity. He never, ever lost that ability to light up a room with his light eyes. But that wit, that Muhammad Ali wit, that Cassius Clay, he was called, sort of the Mouth of the South or something along those lines in his early days, was obviously diminished and latterly almost eradicated. And I do feel as though, obviously it's easy to say in hindsight, that this was the moment, again, for a second time in a transcendental career, to achieve the unachievable against unbeatable foe in Foreman. It would have just been, I think, the moment, maybe indeed, like you say, when the heavens open, God is saying, your job here is done, move on. But again, is now, I guess, you put that in category, one will never know. But great doc, 96 winning Oscar Best Documentary Feature. It richly deserves that. It is truly, truly phenomenal. As always, loving the Verum Sport Podcast. I'm sure you are at home too. And to tell you what, eclectic choices there. Want to keep your views coming in. All things to do with sport generally, of course. But here we are debating, dissecting the best, most relevant and exciting movies and documentaries from the world of sport. And one of those which hasn't made the cut, but I'm sure is a big favourite amongst you out there, is Moneyball. And the Moneyball team of the footballing world are Brentford Football Club, challenging for Premier League status next season. And I had a great chat with their chairman and Radlett's own, Cliff Crown. Great interview there with the Moneyball of the footballing world, Brentford. And I tell you what, he does slightly embrace the moniker. It's a fascinating chat. You're going to enjoy it. You can hear it after this podcast. So check out Volume Sport Podcast. But most crucially, keep involved with us. Love your views. Always look great to hear from you. Continue to tweet at Verulam Sport. But here on now, today's Verulam Sport Podcasting, we're going to continuing on with the best, most relevant, most exciting movies and documentaries from across sport, framing sport, showing the theatre of sport in a documentary or movie context. And now, to provide that insight again, it's Neil Stock. Welcome back, Neil. What you got up for us now?
Yeah, thank you. Right, this one is more of a mainstream one for everybody. Everybody should or would have heard of it, at least, whether it's seen or not, we will never know. But Bend It Like Beckham. Basically, it's about bringing women into football. Nice. Women playing, basically trying to get into a team and getting into the frame of David Beckham, sort of thing, if you like. I haven't seen it. I've seen more, I haven't even seen any clips of it to date, but it's won a lot of accolades in the way of women in movies. So yeah. That's the poignant thing with this, really, that I would like to bring out is women in sport as a whole, not just football. But I think what this has done is actually opened up sport for women.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant shout. And it's something that we always champion here on Viral Sport. I know I have promised this in the past, but very soon we will be talking with Hannah Gallagher, ex-Saracens and England Women's International. We've spoken, of course, with Sarah McKenna, who falls into that very same category. And we always love to champion the important role of women and women's sports. And, of course, the last Footballing World Cup saw the England Lions challenge, and they roared massively. And it is growing in popularity, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a great shout. Tell you what, it's a great
when
movie.
Sorry, Tony. Yeah, when I was down south, if you like, I always used to catch up with Portsmouth ladies and their movements. And it is... If you like, it's a whole different world. It's not what you would expect. There's a lot of... They still have the competition for places, the camaraderie on the pitch, in the dressing rooms. But what I will say about women in football as a sport is the language on the pitch isn't there like it is from the men's game, if that makes sense. If a woman gets tackled, unless it's something really, really, really serious, then they're up, back in it again, rather than rolling around, if you like.
I think it's a wonderful sport, and I'll tell you what, it's certainly growing in popularity, and the quality, more to the point, across all of women's sport is getting better, and indeed better all the time.
Gaining momentum a lot.
But there's no doubt about it, there is still massive glass windows that remain to be shattered. We'll no doubt continue to delve into this important topic. But circling back to the movie, I'll tell you what, it was massively successful, featuring Leicester's own Perminder Negra in the title role. Mm. And it also did. And it did it in a very comedic way, as you say, shining a light on encouraging females in sport, but also crossing cultural boundaries, because that principal character was of kind of Sikh heritage, where just generally being involved with sports isn't something that necessarily gets the kind of encouragement and certainly massively frowned upon from the female perspective. So it had this massive mainstream power. It also featured the one that most people know, lady by the name of Keira Knightley. I think she's reasonably well known. It grossed across the globe over $76 million. So very, very well performing. And again, it does have that kind of crossover appeal, but it does touch upon these very, very important cultural matters. And it delivers it in a very entertaining fashion. And sometimes that's the best way to make these big points. Nobody really likes to be lectured or harangued. But when you're kind of being entertained, it's almost like the spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down a little nicer. And I think it delivered that marvelously. And as you say, everybody knows the phrase, bend it like Beckham. And this movie kind of took that and ran with it. It's a really, really cool movie. And as I say, great performances by Leicester's own Perminder Negra, who went on to star in ER. Fab shout, like it a lot. Jason, your thoughts on Bend It Like Beckham?
Again, it's one that's passed me by, unfortunately, but I have read about it, and I'm a big proponent of women's sport, of course. So I do feel, again, like I've missed out there, but I missed out on Raging Bull and The Last Dance. So these are all kind of added on to my Netflix watch list. But I think it's brilliant that you brought up, Neil, because we are thankfully at a time now where women's sport is more valued. And I've always been a big fan of the Arsenal women's team, and it's quite easy to support them because they are very good at what they do. And it's kind of, discussions within the Arsenal kind of fan groups that probably, you know, we should get some of the ladies into our men's team, because frankly they're much more dedicated, much better than a lot of the people making up the men's team. But yeah, it's nice that it came out, the Bend It Like Beckham film, and 2002 to until now, it is 18 years, and it did break some of the social paradigms around women's football as it's valued. But for me, I'm a little bit disappointed that obviously it's 18 years, and I don't think enough has changed yet to say that it has been a big enough shift to respect women's sport enough. I don't know if you feel the same way,
just
Tony.
I'm going to chime in on this, and I'm going to slightly advocate the devil, because everybody who's listened to Verum Sport will know I'm a massive believer in equality, I'm massively respectful of all the endeavours of the successes of women in sport. And I cannot wait, it will happen very soon, to chat to Helen Gallagher, England women's star, and also Sanderson star. However, I want to throw this out slightly controversially. And so I don't know if you guys clock this, but of course we're talking women's sports, and in this context, in women's football. Well, the all-embracing, all-champion, almost unbeatable team in the global context is the USA, right? Now, I don't know if you clock this. This USA unbeatable women's team played an under-15s youth setup in the States, and they were absolutely shellacked. It was a shellacking. It was, I think, plus 15 goals against. I think they scored two, maybe three. Again, I don't know the full context of that. I don't know whether, to what extent this was, you know, whether they had their big guns in it, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to comment on it with massive authority, but it is something I am aware of. And it just goes to show that, again, while we do want equality, and we do appreciate, no doubt about it, the quality of the women's game across all sports is massively on the up and up. That result, I think, does speak certain volumes. I don't know, just quickly your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, it's kind of putting in reference place the context of it. I do know the kind of result that you're talking about. It's actually a 5-2 the under-15s of Dallas. And actually, some of the people at the time said that it was a bad reflection on Dallas. They should have won by more. I just think it kind of shows you that maybe that women's sport in football, that is, hasn't reached that level yet. But that's because they're not allowed to compete with maybe male counterparts. You know, it's kind of like the discussion around should foreigners in the British leagues. I'm all for as many foreigners as possible, because I think it improves the leagues. And I think that you have seen an improvement in English stars with the kind of influx of foreign players. Now, if women players were allowed to play with male counterparts, then that in turn would probably allow them to improve. So I think...
Just briefly on that, I think that's a great shout. And again, looking forward to chatting to Hannah Gallagher, but we do chat regularly, of course we do, to the voice of the old Albanians, Brian Quinn. And he told me anecdotally that Hannah Gallagher was playing at county level with the male counterparts right up to the age of 14. So at a substantial level, she was deemed, not irrespective of gender, for her position at the time she was a centre, to be the best option for the county at that under 14 level. So I think, Jason, that is a wonderful shout. And we can only witness and see how things do improve. And again, I want to be very, very clear. I personally am a massive advocate of the women's game across all sports. I hope for the day when we can get true parity. But like so many things, there are cultural issues underplay, the current underplaying it all. And until such a point that that is kind of evolved and moved forward, we are always going to have these type of, unfortunately, metaphorical ceilings. But I would like to think in that 18-year span, I mean, look, 18 years ago, I can't imagine that we'd have X number of million eyeballs watching England ladies in the Football World Cup as they were for that effort, where they did lose, I think, to the USA team. So I definitely think progress is there. But of course, Neil, just your final thoughts. I guess we're still far, far removed from true parity.
Yeah, I think that there's still a long way to go, but a lot of the effort's there, from whether it be football, rugby. You see it all the time. You see their training methods. You see their game, the gameplay, the link-up plays. Some of it is better than you would see maybe from, like, the Manchester Uniteds and Man Cities of this world. It's just... It's sometimes I would say better, but obviously the level at what they're playing is not equal to the Premier League. Obviously, it's I wouldn't like to hazard a guess of what sort of equivalent level it would be, but obviously it's not Premier League standard as we know it. However, going touching back on the equality and things like that, what I would say, it doesn't matter on the culture, the race, the colour or whatever. If you've got the skill, then you should be allowed to exploit it.
Yeah, hear, hear, and I'll definitely bang that drum forever and a day. I tell you what drum I'll always bang on about is the beautiful sporting institution that is the British Lions, one of the most unique sporting teams, combination of England, Scotland, Ireland, and England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, the home unions coming together, touring the big three. Every 4 years, they tour South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia. And I tell you what, my final choice is one of the finest documentaries that I've ever seen. Again, I'm obviously biased, a big fan of rugby, huge, huge proponent for the Lions. But Living with Lions 97 is some of the greatest fly on the wall documentary making you could care to see. And it really was phenomenal because it was such a wonderful era of rugby here, because people forget rugby was very late to the table when it came to professionalism. Only officially became professional in 1995. So this 97 era was this wonderful kind of transition where so many of the amateur ethos and kind of culture and sheer jubilation and love intrinsically for the sport shines forth. But with improved professional data analysis, techniques, coaching methodology. And this really does bring all of that to us, the viewer. And it was sensational because a big chat this week, excuse me, about a potential global calendar in rugby union. Goodness knows there's an awful lot of matches to pack in, and that is a problem for the game, bigger picture thinking. And there was talk, coming back to 97 now, that this Lions institution may well be clogging up too much time in the calendar. The previous Lions tournament to 93 saw the New Zealand team absolutely pulverizers and exposes as the Northern Hemisphere lagging behind our cousins in the Southern Hemisphere. But this 97 Lions tour was phenomenal, and it culminated in a 2-1 series victory. They won the first two tests, so the last one was, I guess, a dead rubber. But it is a sensational, because arguably this saved the institution of the Lions, and I'm very grateful that it did. And I'll tell you what, I love the kind of spooky, eerie qualities Jason alluded to earlier in the Senna documentary. Sometimes that maps onto life in large. Check this out. Next year's British Lions tour, which I did a little count back because I'm very sad, a few days ago, was 399 days until it gets going. But they are now taking on, again, South Africa, who in 97, as they are now, are defending Rugby World Cup champions. So I just love that little bit of kind of spooky correlation there. But if you've not seen this documentary, it is a must, because much as I love rugby, this really does take you into the culture of the kind of the team, how it comes together. And what's fascinating is that the two directors actually originally were doing things like, you know, documentaries and, you know, commercials really was their background. And as with all the best ideas, I think, gentlemen, I'm sure you found it yourself, this one, to do a fly-on-the-wall style documentary of the Lions, was concocted, I'm not saying they had a few to drink, but it was certainly in a pub context. Anyway, this is also a bit of a punt for them, the two directors, Duncan Humphreys and his colleague Fred Rees, actually pitched this, so to speak, to the tour manager, ex-England and Lion prop in his own right, a great, great player, great, great rugby administrator, Fran Cotton. And he said, in his wonderful Lancasterian way, straight to the point, sure, fellas, go for it. Going to cost you 30 grand. So they assumed that this would get massively supported by the likes of terrestrial TV, who then obviously, essentially, that would be reimbursed by dint of distribution. Not a bit of it. As I mentioned, at the time, the Lions culture was deemed dead and buried. Everybody assumed that South African champions would absolutely assassinate the Lions, and they assumed, therefore, who's going to want to watch this? So nobody would reimburse them. And they remortgaged the house in order to facilitate this. And I raise a glass for that endeavour, that commitment to your vision, gentlemen. And it's well worth it. And they now, I'm sure, have recouped each and every single penny, because this is just great stuff, fellas. So many wonderful characters. Again, that amateur era. And we were talking a bit earlier in the piece about certain language, perhaps, of dressing room culture. This doesn't pull any punches. 13 F-bombs by the legendary Keith Wood in, check this out, 20-second clip. 13 times that talismanic Irish hooker, one of the legends of the game, dropped the F-bomb. I mean, goodness gracious me. But there's great scenes as well. Wonderful, Jason. You use that great word, camaraderie. And you see it, you smell it, you feel it. It's so powerful. I love the fact that they embrace Wonderwall by Oasis, which, of course, was a big hit around about the same time. Again, these fellas had to pay a penny or two for the privilege to use this. But it was just wonderful. Seriously, everything you'd want from a fly on the wall door talk, doc about a rugby tour done at the highest professionalism was still the amateur drinking culture. You see it. Even Martin Johnson, the great captain, was seen after the first test victory to be enjoying a few champagnes and other drinks. Some seminal scenes. I'm not going to do the great Scottish brogue of Jim Telfer, who was the assistant coach to the legendary Ian McGeachan. But if you want to, if you're feeling a little bit down about yourself or just want a little bit of inspiration, you could do much worse than just banging onto YouTube Jim Telfer's Everest speech. This is your Everest, boys. He did in a much more authentic Scottish brogue than mine. It's wonderful. It truly is inspiring. And Jerry Guscott's last-minute drop goal in that second test to claim the 2-0 victory, which meant that the final test, which the Lions did lose, was basically a dead rubber. 2 hours and 50 minutes of sheer class entertainment. Living with Lions is, for me, right up there with the finest documentaries that I've ever witnessed. Have either of you fellas had the pleasure yet?
I haven't yet, and, you know, I like rugby, but it's not up there on my like list, but what I find interesting of your selection of this, Tony, is kind of almost a moment in history where the rugby ethos kind of changed. As you said there, it was a change of psyche around the Lions. And also it's this moment that which you fantastically described as the professionalisation of rugby. It's kind of like football was in the early 90s, you know, where you had the Premier League kind of in its infancy and you still had the drinking culture. You know, I'm drawing parallels there with the sport that I'm more au fait with, but I just love the fact that this is almost like an origin story and people love that. And it's beautiful that there were cameras there at the moment. And, you know, that is fantastic stuff itself. The story of the origins of the origin film, you know, the fact that it was these people with a real passion for the film, that they mortgaged it, that they put, you know, their whole lives on the line, basically. They could have been homeless if it hadn't worked out. Passion projects like that are truly inspirational. And I'm so glad that there's a document like that for rugby fans to enjoy, Lions fans to enjoy, and just sports fans, because moments like this need to be treasured and documented, because people now in years in the future wonder how did the professionalisation kind of come about, and they can look to this as almost an article in history to kind of say, this is what it was like, this is the change that it brought about.
Jason, wonderfully broken down there. And I will say this much, I'm a massive fan of rugby and a massive fan of kind of documentaries. But the Living with Lions brand has now gone on ever since. So I'm sure it will be there in South Africa again with that eerie kind of transition in just over a year's time. But for my money, none of the others had that same kind of core quality, because we've moved ever further. And I don't want to be a dinosaur totally. I respect change and I appreciate progress and all of that. But none of the others, for my money, had that sort of spirit And again, were great, exposed the culture and the professionalism and the attitude and the outlook, and they were great characters. But just my humble opinion only, none of the others in the Living with Lions brand holds a candle to this very first one, this 97 moment, which, as you say, is a seminal moment in the history of the rugby timing-wise. And certainly, I don't think it's over-egging the souffle to assert that that Lions tour and the victory of the great, great team really did salvage the brand, the Lions, to which I am eternally grateful. Going to back to Jason to whip this 360 wise and give us your final take on what has been a great conversation tonight. What's your final best sporting movie/documentary?
Well, I wanted to get in, obviously, my favourite sport, football. I'm sure some people have realised that now who listen to Verulam Sport Podcast. But I had a real toss-up between two Pep Guardiola-themed films because I kind of wanted to go with him at the moment because he is, you know, the dominating figure in football, though possibly the mantle might be handed over to Mr. Jurgen Klopp for the best coach/manager in the world. So my two were Take the Ball, Pass the Ball and Amazon Prime's fantastic All or Nothing. Now, I plumb for the latter because kind of like your description there of the Lions tour is fly on the wall, but also I think it will be remembered as a seminal work of going into a football club. Now, what a season, of course, to kind of do a documentary on the Centurions, you know, the record-breaking team. If you had to select any kind of team in history, you'd probably go with the 99 treble winners, the Invincibles, maybe Chelsea in the early 05s under Mourinho, and also this Centurions team. And thank goodness we've got this article of history. I kind of want to jump back, though, to the 1970s, because this has the echoes a little bit of Hunter Davis's brilliant work, The Glory Game. You know, that exploration of Tottenham behind the scenes. But what I would say is that, obviously, Man City and Amazon have edited it together to the all the kind of naughty moments, maybe unwanted moments are probably not there, which obviously Hunter Davies was given absolute kind of warts and all access to. So I would say that's a reservation there. But I think as a data man, this documentary shows you where the data kind of falls short. It shows you inside the psyche. It shows you inside the beliefs and also those amazing inspirational kind of chats the Pep gives. And what also for me, it was fascinating to see the inside of a modern super club, from the cooks, cleaners, kit man, that they're all so important to the smooth running of the club. And you kind of don't realize or forget that Mr. Kit Man or this person or that person needs to know all these things about the players, their diets, this and that. Amazing how it culminates. What I would say as well, as an Arsenal fan, it's scary how quickly Man City have created this super club and one of the best academies in the world. They based it on the AC Milan one in Italy, and their training ground is, you know, something like sci-fi from the future. They have these kind of chambers, I'm trying to think of the actual word, they're like ice chambers for players to recover in. You saw company going in, it just... stuff from the future, but it's here now. And also, I'd like to chat about, actually, there was controversy around the actual making of this documentary. Sky were very angry that Man City kind of went to Amazon instead of them, and kind of the traditional broadcasters. It also brings into the discussion of, is it good that more broadcasters are now charging for Premier League football, because Amazon are now doing that? But does it give the consumer more choice, or the fact that we've got to pay for more kind of subscriptions? But also, interestingly, one of probably the most controversial moments of the season, a fight in the tunnel between Man United and Manchester City, wasn't documented because they weren't allowed the cameras to be brought into the Old Trafford Stadium. Man United said a big no-no, which is really interesting as well. I don't know if that's because of inter-city rivalry, because they didn't want Man City to have an all-encompassing kind of documentary. But the fact of the matter is that it's one of, again, for me, one of the best kind of insights into a modern club. And hopefully it kind of breaks this barrier that there is between, or that there has been between football clubs and the outside world, kind of before they were closed off institutions. And I think in a way, Hunter Davies kind of held back people going into clubs because the warts and all did kind of bring negative things about Tottenham to the fore. And maybe people were scared for that to happen again. But thankfully, Tottenham have signed up to that. And it will be all about this season with Pochettino leaving the club. So that will be like a real fireworks display. But I'm hoping that more clubs kind of do that. But I don't know, Neil and Tony, what are your feelings on All or Nothing? Because for me, it was tactics, it was an insight into a club, and it was all-encompassing into one of the best Premier League teams of all time.
Neil, quickly, your thoughts on all these wonderful points Jason has brought to the table.
I haven't seen it. I've heard bits and pieces about it. And to be honest, I find it very fascinating to know how the clubs run, what goes on behind the scenes, because to a general supporter, all you know is they walk out of the tunnel at 3 o'clock, playing 90 minutes of football. Then you may see a couple of medics dealing with an injury, and then they're off the pitch. And you have the post-match interviews, and then on to the next game. You don't see, as Jason was saying, you don't see the cooks getting involved and knowing each player's diets. You don't see the accountants doing what they do within the club, the marketing teams, the ticket offices. You just don't know it. There is so much that goes on, press offices. There is a lot that goes on behind the scenes, even coming down to the grass cutting and the lining.
It's the machine within the machine, isn't it, I suppose?
But the thing that strikes me is that is the main big difference between a pro club and, say, going down the leagues to most probably a team outside of the conference structure, where you can actually see and get involved at a personal level with the groundsmen, the bar staff, the players. Once you hit conference level, conference south, north, national, once you sort of get to that point, it starts to get that little bit more secretive, if you know what if you understand where I'm coming from. The doors start to close, if you like.
Sure.
From that,
I'll tell you what, just moving on to this Bodoka Man City All or Nothing. I haven't actually seen it. I love that it was narrated though by Sir Ben Kingsley, Oscar winner, who himself grew up in Salford, and you know, just one of those wonderful voices, a true great of his art. I want to just a final point before we bring things on to some Premier League action previews. Jason, I think you've raised the political sphere here, again, where politics and art and sport and business fuse into one sort of amalgam, and as to whether it's a positive one or a negative one, moot. And I have many views. They are wide and diverse. I think in many ways is a positive thing because, again, it potentially enables clubs to broker their own chances, gather more money, gather et cetera, et cetera. But overall, I suspect that then it may be a model that we experience in Spain, where essentially Real and Barcelona essentially dominate in terms of the monetary flow the money that the TV can provide, for instance. So let's speculate and just imagine a hypothetical universe where Brentford bees. You can hear from Cliff Crown, their chairman, in a moment or two, get promoted to the Premier League. And we're in this sort of Wild West where everybody can negotiate for Amazon maybe, or Netflix perhaps, or, you know, whatever it might be, YouTube, I don't know, there's so many. Unlikely to be able to compete in terms of negotiation, dominant monetary flow with, for instance, Man City. And that could potentially, whilst it maybe opens up doors and avenues, will be more detrimental than the fact that the mega money, well, again, has its pros and its cons, not the time to delve into it deeply. But the mega money that the clubs, the promised land of the Premier League represents, is now, as Graham explained in our previous podcast, got almost nada to do with sales of season tickets or even, you know, kit. It's about the Sky cash cow. And that can last for many a while. And it does give teams like, I don't know, a Watford, a Bournemouth, a chance to really kind of nurture, develop, sustain something if they manage it reasonably well. I mean, history shows us, for instance, Leeds have managed it poorly and have suffered the consequences. But I think the Sky cash cow, for want of a better phrase, does give that parity quality factor and does ensure, again, that there will be a Super Sunday, which is going to be inclusive of things like the Cherries and, you know, Brighton, as well as the big Uber powers, the big four, as it were. So I think it's a great chat. As always, I'd encourage you listening with your fascinating views on this topic to get involved. Your views on Wild West and TV brokering or Sky Big Dollar, or, you know, are you a totally extremist? Do you think all this money in sport's gone mad, ruining things? Whatever your views may be, love to hear from you. But now, circling back, as every great sporting movie or documentary must have a wonderful narrative arc, we began tonight by reviewing the drama of the Premier League, and we're going to end with a bit of a rapid-fire preview for the upcoming fixtures, starting with Monday, June the 22nd. We're going to go to Neil Stark, Man City. They've been mentioned a lot tonight of the defending champions, the Blues. Tackle Burnley. Your thoughts?
Just a quick one, just before I give my prediction on that one. What I found last night as a good touch is Man City wearing those new shirts with the supporting the charities reference COVID-19, etc. I think that was quite a nice touch for City, which would expose them more in a community, which gives it a more of a brings the super club back down to community level, if that makes sense.
It does. It's a great shout. Your thoughts on the game there? Man City Burnley.
Man City scoring well last night. Burnley haven't played again yet, but what I would say, that game all going well, I think it's another Pep win.
Interesting stuff. They're still not mathematically out of the title race, but of course, as you say, Liverpool just two wins away from the title, so it would seem. Tuesday the 23rd, the title winners from 2014, Leicester City, hosting Brighton. Your thoughts, Neil?
Okay, that one, I reckon, as much as I would like to think Brighton will get something out of that one, being right down in that relegation dogfight, I think it's actually going to be a Leicester home win.
Two home wins for you in these two. Going again on the 23rd, Tuesday. Spurs host West Ham, a London derby. Your thoughts?
London derby. I've got to go with a home win again.
Three consecutive home wins from Neil Stark. Moving on now to Wednesday, the 24th. Man United, much improved under Solskjaer. Take on maybe the team of the year from the overachieving perspective. Sheffield United. Man United versus Sheffield United. Neil, your thoughts?
All things told, everything how it is at the moment. Sheffield United unlucky with the Hawkeye decision, etc., which we talked about earlier. But I actually do think this one would be an excellent draw for Sheffield United.
Draw there. Newcastle versus Villa.
Home win.
Home win for Newcastle. Wolves, again, we praised them massively. Bournemouth in the dogfight right now in the final relegation spaces. Wolves versus Bournemouth. Quickly, Neil, your thoughts?
Wolves, Bournemouth, home win.
Home win. Liverpool then, could they get another 3 points, which would edge them over closer? They just need six. Liverpool Palace again, Wednesday the 24th.
I reckon that's a home win as well.
And then Nana McKenna's favourites. I know she's a bit of a gunner at heart too, but Norwich versus Everton. Neil, quickly, your take on that one.
Away win.
Away win for Everton. Then Burnley versus Watford, Thursday the 25th. Quickly, Neil.
Away win.
A win for the Hornets. We'll find out and hear from Richard Walker again very soon. Southampton versus the Gunners of Arsenal.
I think I've got to be very, very careful on how I answer this one because a certain machine may come rapidly to, in my direction. I think the stick my neck out home win.
Interesting one there. I'll definitely have to keep an eyeball on that one. I think there could well be fisticuffs. And then final one, Thursday the 25th, Chelsea again versus Man City, who are busy in the return of the Premier League. Chelsea versus Man City, Neil.
Draw.
Gone for a draw. Well, listen, thank you ever so much for your time. Thank you for listening. Make sure you stick tuned. We've got Cliff Crown from Radlett, who is the chairman of the High Flying Brentford. Make sure you listen out for Ian Allenson and family. Betty Allenson has made an amazing amount of money getting on her bike for charity, as indeed has Jim Hodgkin. We're going to hear from him on Friday evening. That'll be there for you. Also, I'm going to chat on Saturday to John McKenna from the More Than a Manager movie we've talked about tonight. So much wonderful podcasting for you to enjoy. Make sure you're with us. Keep involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport. And I wish you every continued joy and happiness. Thank you.